Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hello, I'm Katia Adler. Today on The Global Story, I'll be taking a look into the multi-million dollar international Christmas music industry and asking, what is the recipe for a successful Christmas song? And why do the old tunes do the best? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and new perspectives from BBC journalists all around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
The Global Story is the podcast helping you make sense of the news. Join me, Katia Adler, every weekday as I take a closer look at the stories making the headlines with insights from the BBC's global network of experts. Search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Brandt, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 3rd of December, these are our main stories. As Israel's renewed bombardment of Gaza continues, the UN's Children's Agency has described the dropping of leaflets telling Palestinians to go to safe areas as cynical. The UN's annual climate summit has heard further pledges from energy firms and governments to tackle climate change. Critics point out the statements aren't binding, though. Reports from Russia say police there have raided gay clubs in Moscow days after the Supreme Court outlawed what it called the international LGBT movement. Also in this podcast, what's going on in your brain when you look at a piece of art?
I am just looking at my own brainwaves, and I think what is so fascinating about this is that the visualisation shows these as beautiful waves that are kind of crashing over each other and into each other.
So we're going to begin in Gaza, where the temporary truce is now a distant memory. People ran for cover on Saturday as missiles hit apartment buildings in the Hamad town area of Khan Yunis. The city was targeted by a series of airstrikes and artillery fire after the second day of resumed fighting. Several hundred thousand people from northern Gaza had fled there, some camping in tents, others in schools and around hospitals. The Hamas-run health ministry says around 200 Palestinians have now been killed since the ceasefire expired on Friday. Israel says it's introduced measures, though, such as the dropping of information leaflets and downloadable maps to try to prevent civilian casualties as the fighting moves south. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the resumption of the ground invasion of Gaza was the only way to destroy Hamas.
We will continue the war until we reach all its goals. And these goals cannot be achieved without the ground operation. The ground operation has been essential in bringing the results so far, and it will be essential in bringing the results later.
Well, as Israel's renewed bombardment of the Gaza Strip continues to intensify, the UN's children's agency, UNICEF, has described the dropping of leaflets telling Palestinians to go to safe areas as almost cynical. Residents in the area have described the airstrikes there as the heaviest bombing of the war. Vishala Sripatmar spoke to UNICEF spokesman James Elder, who's in Khan Yunis, and first asked him about aid getting into Gaza.
Prior to the horrors of October 7, 500 trucks would come into the Gaza Strip, commercial and United Nations. Of course, for long periods in these last 7 weeks, it's been none. So 50 is still, it's triage. Everything right now is kind of triage, trying to almost stem the bleeding. It does not allow for a meaningful humanitarian response. And so the notion that now of a massive disease outbreak, you know, middle-class families who've lost homes, seen family members killed, many family members, it's quite relentless, the bombardments here. Moved twice, three times, and now they're living on 3 or 4 litres of water a day, carrying what they've got, not enough food. Sewage and sanitation systems are broken down. There's no fuel for them. And, of course, many of the workers are dead or displaced. This is a nightmare. And as maybe you can hear or not, the bombardments continue with some severity.
And in terms of the sort of situation with zones, these areas that are now designated as unsafe zones, how helpful has that been? Because that's what Israel is saying now, that they're going to designate areas as unsafe zones to alert people and civilians in Gaza that these aren't areas that they should be, because that, those are areas that are targets for them.
Yes, and I'm told that some of those warnings come as an SMS 10 minutes before. Almost illogical, almost cynical. Some of the leaflets that have come about where, which safe zones to go have a QR code on them. That would be for someone who had been able to power their phone in a place where there's no electricity apart from, say, a generator, and certainly where there's no access to 4G or 5G Wi-Fi at all. These would be the same people who were in a safe place in the north in a UN shelter that was bombed, and they've come here and been told to go somewhere else. It's not real, and I'm very unsettled by the notion that people are taking root with this idea. I see the families on the street. You see the anxiety of looking at a child when they know, as a child said today, when their mother was crying, said, "My mum just doesn't know where she's going." Not that she was lost, but she was in a trance. She's run out of places to go. They were trying to set up their home on a sidewalk. So there is nowhere to go. And the idea that this place is safe or this isn't, unfortunately, gets proven to be false in a lethal way for children when they're hit and it was a safe place.
And James, can you tell us a bit about where you are right now?
Yeah, I'm in Khan Yunis, so not far from Nasser Hospital, densely populated. I mean, 1.8 million people are now in this area. So, and this is it's more explosion. I'm not far from the sea, so again, have no military expertise, but some of these I'm understanding that would be artillery from the Navy, and the ones that really shake the windows, or worse, glass is your great fear with these things. Glass and shrapnel do horrible things to a child's body. So it's a guest house of sorts that we have for staff. There's a base, and then you go on convoys to the north or delivering aid here wherever we can possibly get aid to. I know the north is unreachable at the moment.
Well, that was James Elder, UNICEF spokesperson, who was in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. The deputy head of Hamas's political wing has said there will be no more hostage exchanges in Gaza until there's a permanent ceasefire. Sheikh Salah al-Arouri added that the remaining hostages held by Hamas are all either soldiers or former soldiers and won't be released under the same terms as those already freed. Earlier, it emerged that the head of Israel's Mossad security service had ordered his negotiating team to pull out of ceasefire talks in Qatar. David Barnea said the discussions had reached a dead end. A statement from the Israeli Prime Minister's office said Hamas had failed to fulfil its obligations under the truce agreement. Well, regarding all these developments, I spoke to our correspondent, Paul Adams, who is in Jerusalem. And I first asked him for his assessment, as the fighting goes on, of Israel's strategy of issuing information maps of so-called safe and unsafe areas in the south of Gaza.
We have, for the first time today, the use of this new map in which the whole Gaza Strip's been broken down into tiny little grid squares. And for the first time, we saw a map with a cluster of those squares being an area where the Israelis said, that is where we're going to conduct military operations. You should leave that area if you want to be safe. In other words, what I think we're seeing now is less of an emphasis on safe areas and more of an emphasis on unsafe areas. In other words, if you go out beyond this shaded area, you will be safe from airstrikes. But Palestinians, for the last 2 months, know that often they find themselves in places where there are airstrikes where they thought they were safe, because the Israelis continue to conduct raids against what they consider to be high-value Hamas targets. And those can happen anywhere and at any time.
And on the ceasefire talks, the Mossad chief is pulling his people back, but we see that France's President Emmanuel Macron heading to Qatar to try and drum things up again. I mean, where you are, what's the talk of in terms of prospects, maybe not perhaps for the next few days, but in the week ahead for another ceasefire?
I would be very surprised if we see any negotiations resuming that soon. Certainly Hamas officials are saying We will not see any more hostages released until the military operation is over. Well, they might say that. I don't think that Emmanuel Macron will by himself be able to revive a process that, you know, has been a very, very delicate, complex set of negotiations involving the Israelis, the Egyptians, the Qataris, and obviously officials from Hamas. It seems to have broken down for now. It's all about fighting. At some point, who knows, we may return to those negotiations, but I don't feel that that's going to happen soon.
Paul Adams in Jerusalem. Well, one last detail on the war in Israel and Gaza. The Palestinian Higher Education Ministry in Gaza says a prominent scientist and his family have been killed in an Israeli airstrike near Gaza City. Soufiane Taye was president of the Islamic University of Gaza and a lead researcher in physics and applied mathematics. Now, police in Russia have raided several LGBTQ clubs in the capital in what's being seen by some as more evidence of a crackdown on the gay community. Officers said they were looking for drugs in the venues in Moscow, but it follows a ruling in the Russian Supreme Court a few days ago which classed the international LGBT movement as an extremist organisation. I spoke to our Europe regional editor Paul Moss and asked him for more on the background to the story.
In some ways, this is an old story. LGBT rights in Russia have gone up and down through history. It was actually back in 1832 that it was made illegal for, as they put it, for a man to lie down with another man. Being caught violating that law could get you exiled to Siberia. The Bolshevik Revolution in 1917 legalized homosexuality. Stalin recriminalized it. Then when communism fell in the early 90s, Mikhail Gorbachev loosened restrictions. I hope you're keeping up here. And then under Vladimir Putin, though, there's been a steady crackdown. First, there were laws preventing the promotion of homosexuality. At times, this produced sort of absurd results. There was a Korean pop video, for example, that had some rainbow colours and they were blotted out when it was shown on television. But then, as you mentioned, yeah, there has been this recent crackdown. On Thursday, the Ministry of Justice went to the Supreme Court and had the international LGBT movement declared an extremist organisation. Have to say, this is the first time I've ever heard of an organisation being made illegal, which, as far as I can tell, doesn't actually exist. It's as if the Russian authorities needed an LGBT bogeyman to attack, so they invented one.
OK, so that's the kind of history lesson and the cultural ebb and flow. But take us to Friday night. What actually happened in terms of these police raids in Moscow?
Well, it seems that four bars were raided. We're relying, by the way, on local media here, and also a male sauna. Police went in, checked identity papers, photographed them. There were foreigners present, had their passports looked at. This is clearly very intimidating at a time when many people in Russia are getting given long prison sentences for any kind of violation or dissent at all. Now, this may sound like a minor matter relative to everything else going on in Russia. You've got a war going on, hundreds of thousands being sent to fight, many of them never to come back. But in fact, in some ways, you could see this crackdown on the LGBT community actually as central to everything. This is because Vladimir Putin has portrayed the conflict in Ukraine as a defensive war and telling people not only the West and NATO want to conquer Russia, but telling them they want to, you know, to crack down, destroy your morals, destroy your values. As far as some people are concerned, in the Kremlin worldview, raiding a gay bar in Moscow is a war on the home front, just as important as firing shells at Ukrainian troops in the Donbass. And for that reason, I suspect we're going to see more of this.
Paul Moss. Another agreement has been announced at the UN Climate Change Conference in Dubai. This one is on renewables. The COP28 meeting, as it's known, has started with a flurry of announcements. More than 100 countries have promised to aim to treble their use of renewable energy, like solar and wind power, by 2030. But a key figure speaking on Saturday also appeared to lower expectations on efforts to slow the increase in global temperatures. China's envoy, Xi Jinhua, claimed that his country is facing huge challenges in controlling methane gas emissions, which is a major contributor to global warming. Our climate editor Justin Rowlett is there and starts his report with details on a man who was supposed to make it, but in the end couldn't go.
The Pope couldn't make it to Dubai. His doctor forbade him from travelling, but a cardinal read his words. Climate change has run amok, he said, and posed a question for the gathered leaders.
Are we working for a culture of life or a culture of death? To all of you, I make this heartfelt appeal. Let us choose life. Let us choose the future.
He said, fossil fuels have to go, and the Secretary General of the UN agrees.
Let's just let us keep moving.
Today, the Chinese climate envoy Xi Jinhua and his American counterpart John Kerry entered the meeting side by side, a sign of their closeness on the climate issue.
Gentlemen, will you commit to phasing out fossil fuels here in the UAE?
I think you're going to hear a good discussion in the next few days.
So no public commitments, but the US vice president said America understands the challenge.
The urgency of this moment is clear. The clock is no longer just ticking, it is banging. We need transformative change and exponential impact.
And it sounds like the president of these talks, Dr. Sultan Al-Jaber, has also got the memo.
The world can break down if we don't rapidly transition to zero carbon alternatives. These are facts we must come to terms with.
So does that mean the UAE believes the world can finally agree to phase out the use of unabated fossil fuels? That's when you capture the CO2 to stop it causing climate change. Here's what Simon Steele, the head of the UN body that runs these talks, had to say.
We have to try, and it's up to parties.
That is UN speak for only the countries of the world can make that call. But there are some tantalising hints here at COP28 that the world could be gearing up for a really consequential decision, a promise to phase out fossil fuels over the coming decades.
Justin Rowlatt reporting from the United Arab Emirates. Still to come.
In October, sensors picked up changes in the direction and severity of the tilt. A further inspection revealed that some material in the base of the tower, like the stone and brick, had begun disintegrating.
The Leaning Tower in Italy that could be about to collapse. And no, it's not the one in Pisa. Now, as we record this, the United Nations says that two overcrowded boats carrying around 400 ethnic Rohingyas are thought to be drifting in the Andaman Sea. It's appealed to countries in Southeast Asia to search for the vessels, which have engine problems. The Rohingya are originally from Myanmar, but fled the country because of persecution by the Burmese army. Our Asia-Pacific editor Mickey Bristow told James Kumarasamy more.
Well, we think they've come from Bangladesh and the refugee camps there containing nearly a million Rohingya people, and they're on their way to countries in Southeast Asia, Malaysia, Indonesia primarily. Already in the last few weeks, we've had about 1,000 Rohingya refugees arrived in Aceh province in Indonesia, and more actually have arrived, 100 or so, on Saturday. And these two boats, though, are at sea. Now, the United Nations, which has put out an appeal for countries to go and help them, believe that the engines have failed. There are 400 people on board. It's not clear if they have enough food or water. They talk about, the UN talks about the weather situation being unpredictable. So there's a real fear for the lives of these people on these boats.
And what has led to this exodus from the refugee camps?
Well, it happens every year about this time because the Andaman Sea is just calm enough for boats to make this journey. And not all of them are really seaworthy. Not all of them are in great condition. A lot of them are overcrowded. So usually it's from November onwards that these journeys are made. And it's happened for the last few years and it's happening now. There are a couple of other things which are happening, though, to perhaps this year make this situation more acute. Firstly, in Myanmar, there's been an uptick and an upsurge in violence, and that's where these Rohingya people originally came from, many of them in 2017 when they were forced out by the Burmese army. Also, many of these refugees, a lot of them live in a camp called Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh, and the situation, the security situation there has just got worse. There's a lot more violent crime, a lot of guns, a lot of robberies. This is what the UN is saying. And so their immediate, these people's immediate safety and security isn't assured. So if you can see a situation developing where we're not safe where we are now, we don't see us ever being able to go back to our original homes, that's going to force people to make more desperate decisions.
And what awaits them on the other side? Those who've made these crossings already, what kind of life can they expect?
That's a good question, and it's an uncertain one. Just over the last few weeks, as I mentioned, about 1,000 Rohingya refugees have arrived in Aceh province, Indonesia's Aceh province. And a lot of the people there, they're just not really welcoming. A lot of local people are saying, just we don't want them here permanently. We're prepared to accept them in the short term, not in the long term.
That's Mickey Bristow, our Asia Pacific editor. Burkina Faso and Niger have followed Mali and announced that they are withdrawing from an international force that was set up to fight Islamist militants in the Sahel region. All three countries are run by military rulers following coups and have now formed their own alliance. Chad and Mauritania are still part of the G5 force, which is meant to be made up of around 5,000 soldiers. Our Africa regional editor Will Ross has more.
A statement from the military-led governments of Burkina Faso and Niger was critical of the G5 force for failing to make the Sahel region safer. It also suggested the anti-jihadist force was serving foreign interests. They almost certainly meant France. Relations with the former colonial power have dramatically deteriorated. The big question is what impact this will have on the Islamist militant groups that have been growing in strength. So far, there's no evidence to suggest that having soldiers in charge of the country makes the population any safer from the threat of these Al-Qaeda and IS-linked fighters.
Will Ross. Next, to the BBC's 100 Women of 2023. Gloria Steinem has been a leader of the global feminist movement since the 1970s, championing equality as a journalist, a writer and a spokesperson. And she's been named in this year's BBC Award. Gloria Steinem has been talking to the BBC's Farah Nakamidi about the progress in women's rights that she's seen and the main challenges that remain.
We need to be honest and say what we're thinking. I mean, men can't read our minds. But it is not our responsibility to make their revolution and their dinner. You and I have grown up in some form of patriarchy.
Yeah.
That says that even in the family, women are more responsible for taking care of infants and small children than men are, even though men are parents too. So that's where a lack of democracy begins, and that's the beginning of change that we all can make. Where the idea of domination and a lack of democracy begins is in the family. And it's even more important and even more the cause of future conflict to grow up with making discrimination and domination okay than national policies are. The most obvious and simplest is that we can determine the fate of our own physical selves. So we can decide whether and when to have children, not to have children, because that's where our difficulty begins, because we happen to have wombs, and the desire to control wombs is very central to authoritarian systems. So, you know, it's clear that controlling reproduction is crucial, yet when we talk about politics, we don't usually start there.
Another thing that nowadays everybody's talking about is cancel culture. You know, there is this fear of speaking up, especially among the younger generation. What do you think of that? Do you actually think that this is compromising the freedom of speech?
I don't feel it myself, but I resent it on behalf of anybody who does feel it, because free speech is crucial to any democracy. We should not submit to cancel culture. It's social pressure as censorship. Even when it is suppressing evidence of bias, it still is silencing people.
Now, what would you say is the biggest misconception people make about you?
Well, occasionally, especially when I was traveling a lot, people seemed surprised that I had a sense of humor.
You're not just an angry feminist, huh?
Right. I think also if people look at the movement and think that it is more limited to college-educated white women than it really is. It's often started in quite the reverse way. If there is any legacy, I would just say that I was trying to make the world a little more fair and a little more representative than it was when I got here. That each of us is unique, so we shouldn't try to be like somebody else, but perhaps we can gain support and inspiration from knowing people who came before us.
Gloria Steinem, who is one of this year's BBC's 100 Women. And if you want to find out more about her and the other women on this year's list, then go to bbc.co.uk/100women. Next, to Italy, and a medieval tower in the country has been sealed off because of a change in how much it's leaning. And this isn't the world-famous Leaning Tower of Pisa. The Garisenda Tower in the city of Bologna is 47 metres high and it's tilted for hundreds of years. But the authorities there say it's now unsafe and they fear it may collapse. Harry Bly has more.
Bologna in northern Italy is famous for its food, culture and historic buildings. Among them are two medieval towers, and they're both leaning. They're known as Le Due Torri, or Two Towers, and were built more than 900 years ago. The Asinelli Tower is twice as high and open for the public to climb, but it's the other tower that's become a problem. The Garisenda Tower leans more at a 4-degree angle, a similar tilt to that of the famous bell tower in Pisa. But in October, sensors picked up changes in the direction and severity of the tilt. A further inspection revealed that some material in the base of the tower, like the stone and brick, had begun disintegrating and cracks had appeared. In order to protect the tower itself and the people and buildings surrounding it, the local council has begun constructing a 5-metre-high barrier, as well as metal containers and wire mesh to catch any falling debris. It's estimated that just a protection barrier surrounding the tower will cost more than $4.5 million. The council has begun a crowdfunding campaign to fund the restoration work. These bright red barriers will only be temporary, and then new research will begin to find a way to stabilise the tower and then correct the underlying problem. Cracks in the brick have been noted previously on this tower. In 2020, steel rods and cables were fitted around the base, but these are said to have aggravated the problem. A collapse is not believed to be imminent, but the authorities are taking precautions. A scientific committee has been monitoring the site since 2019. Equipment including acoustic and movement sensors monitor the building's lean every 15 minutes. And if there's a warning of a collapse, the surrounding area can be evacuated.
Harry Bly. Now, we're coming to an end now, but first I'm going to ask you to concentrate on your brain. Specifically, what's going on inside it when you look at a painting or a photograph or a building, any work of art in fact. Well, a gallery and museum tour is just about to get underway here in the UK, and it lets visitors put on a headset and see a real-time 3D computer representation of their brainwaves. Caroline Wyatt got to try it out at the Victoria and Albert Museum here in London.
So we're going to put this headset on you. It's a simple EEG headset. It goes over your ears. I'm Will McNeil, and I'm a creative director at a digital agency called The Mill, and we were brought on to design and develop the technology for this project. It's measuring electromagnetic activity off your brain. And then this application, which we've written, translates it into this 3D animation, which shows a lot of different things about what's going on in your brain as you're looking at art.
You have a screen in the middle, and I'm now wearing this headset. And I'm not looking at the art, I am just looking at my own brainwaves. And I think what is so fascinating about this is that the visualization shows these as beautiful waves that are kind of crashing over each other and into each other. And they kind of flow amazingly.
I'm Jenny Waldman. I'm director of Art Fund. We were fascinated to find out more about what happens to our brains when we look at art. And what we've found is that art genuinely does inspire our brains to make different connections. So we could really genuinely say that art is beneficial for us. But what's really interesting, post-pandemic, 40% of people are not really going to museums anymore. So this is a way that Art Fund can just remind us all, post-pandemic, we could all get back into museums, and that would be fantastic.
It's the shape and the movement of the waves that's really telling us what's happening in your head right now. So we've identified the pattern in brainwaves that occurs when someone is going through sort of problem solving, trying to understand what they're looking at. And we've turned that into a kind of corkscrewing effect. So the three-dimensional animation starts to kind of wrap around itself and weave. So Caroline's looking at a painting by Degas. It's quite a dark scene, and There's an orchestra in the foreground, but in the background, the actual opera scene is a little bit convoluted, a little bit hard to read.
What I'm trying to figure out in this painting is, am I looking at the orchestra? Am I looking at the audience? Because it's a wonderful painting, but it's not entirely clear.
And we can see some things happening in Caroline's brainwaves here where we're starting to see some corkscrewing. She's trying to kind of understand the scene. Your mind is processing a lot. Your visual cortex is working.
Did you always have an interest in what happens to the brain when people look at art?
I mean, I am a digital artist, so I am always trying to be creative with technology. But I'm also interested in what art does to me, how art makes me feel. I work in a field where I'm often under a lot of pressure to create things quickly and be creative at the same time. It's quite a nice experience for me to go into a gallery and just relax and look at art. Seeing this does actually confirm what I expected, which is that looking at art is not a passive thing. Our brains are very active when we look at art, and we are going through a type of meditation when we look at art, and I think that's really important people recognize that.
Well, that was Caroline Wyatt and her brilliant brainwaves, with the help of a few others, at the Victoria and Albert Museum here in London. Well, that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Jonathan Greer. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Robin Brandt. Until next time, thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Hello, I'm Katia Adler. Today on The Global Story, I'll be taking a look into the multi-million dollar international Christmas music industry and asking, what is the recipe for a successful Christmas song? And why do the old tunes do the best? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and new perspectives from BBC journalists all around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.